Is Christian support for Israel waning today? And why should Christians stand with Israel?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
If I tell you there's a dull moment in my life, I assume that you will know I'm telling you the truth. This is Michael Brown. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. 866-348-7884, the number to call. If you have a Jewish-related question of some kind, anything relating to Hebrew or Middle East issues, Israel, Jewish people, do our best to get to some of your calls today, 866-34-TRUTH. I've got a special guest that will be joining me shortly to talk about the attack on Christian support for Israel. I'll tell you about my never-dull-moment comment in a moment, but I am here in Huntsville, Alabama, broadcasting live, of course, here in Huntsville, Alabama, getting ready for a conference speaking tonight and tomorrow morning. And I'm broadcasting with my radio equipment and our special setup that allows me to do studio-quality broadcast from anywhere in the world. I'm sitting in the pastor's office that they set aside for me, and I just noticed that as I look straight across, there's one little flag in the room, one and only one, and it is the flag of Israel. Why this connection to Israel? Why this recognition of the importance of Israel? We'll talk about that in a little while. But first, I posted an article last night. The mayor of Philadelphia becomes an Islamic scholar when Mayor Jim Kenney last week explained that an radical Islamist terrorist attack last week had nothing to do with Islam, and everybody knows it had nothing to do with Islam. And I just asked him the question, since when did he become an Islamic scholar? I saw an article that came out right after mine from mayor to imam, something like that. I had mentioned that President Bush had said Islam is a religion of peace, and I said I didn't know that he was an Islamic scholar either, and just said, hey, there are millions and millions of Muslims who renounce this terror, who despise the terrorism, who say it has nothing to do with their religion, and I respect that, and there are millions of Muslims who support it. And my article was discussing that. So somebody posted a comment, we'll just give her first name, Mary. And anyway, she made a comment. I responded, which most of the time I can't interact on Facebook because of the flood of comments and posts we have. I responded, excuse me, but did you read the article? She responded, no, I don't usually. I get too mad. So either I'm agreeing with it or I'm disagreeing with it. Either way, that's my opinion. I responded, and please be kind enough not to comment since your comment is utterly irrelevant in light of what the article actually says. Thanks. Okay. Then another fellow posts his comment, and he says this. Again, my article was dealing with issues having to do with radical violent Islam. He posts his comment, first name Dudu. I am proud to be a Muslim. I asked him in response, are you proud of ISIS? He wrote back, are you proud of Zionist Ku Klux Klan? This kind of nonsense is what you get sometime, and it's very common on social media. That's why I said never a dull moment for me here. So evangelical Christian support for Israel has been very strong for many years. When I came to faith as a Jewish believer in Jesus in 1971, the church where I came to faith was strongly, strongly pro-Israel. That's been what I've experienced around the world for decades. Is it the norm? Can we expect that? And is there a biblical basis for it, a historical basis for it? We'll take that up with my guest, Tricia Miller, on the other side of the break. You're listening to The Line of Fire. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, friends, to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. I was in India last year in December, my 23rd straight year going to India, and I visited the fastest growing church in the world, a congregation that has grown from 25 members to 130,000 in 10 years. And I noticed while I was there that the pastor had on his desk a flag of India and a flag of Israel. And when you walk in the door, you're greeted with shalom. Interesting. The month before that, I was in Hungary at the largest mega church of largest mega church of Europe, with 70,000 members there. And that church has a very, very strong connection to Israel. In fact, they've even had men like Elie Wiesel speak from their pulpit, and Israeli leaders speak from their pulpit. And of course, there are groups in America like Christians United for Israel, led by Pastor John Hagee. And historically, the Evangelical Church in America and in Europe has strongly supported Israel, but there is some attack on that, some challenges to that. There's a major conference coming up on Monday in California that's going to address these things. And my guest today is Tricia Miller. She's a scholar, a PhD in Hebrew Bible from Claremont, and she is a senior research and analyst for the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, known by the acronym of CAMERA. Tricia, welcome to the Line of Fire. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
My joy. I do want to get to some of your academic studies in a bit and your work on the Book of Esther. But first, tell our listeners about CAMERA. I'll often cite their work in terms of checking headlines and holding people accountable. But what is CAMERA? What does CAMERA do?
Well, CAMERA stands for the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America. It's an organization that was founded in 1982 to combat the bias in the media about Israel. So what CAMERA does in general is monitor all the news. We have, obviously, an English department, a Hebrew department, Spanish department, and we have a Christian department to focus on the Christian media and Christian organizations in relation to Israel. And we address errors. We ask for corrections when there's a need to be something that needs to be corrected. And we just try to have the record set straight. We try to present the facts.
All right, so you're after the facts. You're not looking for a particular pro-Israel narrative. You simply want factual reporting.
Yes, that's right.
Now, what about the notion that there is a large amount of Jewish influence in the media, that some major companies and organizations have been owned by Jews or had a large Jewish presence, a disproportionate Jewish influence in the media, the whole standard libel that Jews control the world and they control the media? There's certainly a lot of Jewish influence. How can it be that there is anti-Israel reporting if there is such Jewish-dominated media?
Well, that's exactly it. You took the words out of my mouth. That is part of the libel. It's an old libel that the Jews control the world. It's obviously not true. If the Jews control the world, then why has there been persecution in every generation for the Jews? And like you said, if they control the media, then you would think it would be a little more pro-Jewish or pro-Israel.
All right, so then that's just another standard anti-Semitic lie. Jews control the economy, Jews control the media, etc.
That's right.
All right, what have you seen over the decades? You've been working with CAMERA for a certain period of time, but they've been at it since 1982, sometimes documenting headlines, be it in BBC or the LA Times, where if there's an act of aggression by Palestinians against Israelis, it'll say something like 3 Israelis killed by bomb explosion without telling you who was behind the bomb explosion. And then if it's Israelis in an act of aggression, say a retaliation against Palestinian terrorists, it'll say 3 Palestinians killed by Israelis. Are you still seeing those things? Are things getting better, worse?
Yes. No, if anything, it's getting worse. The New York Times is one of the worst. We have 2 people in our office who really focus on that, a large percentage of their time, 2 people. than following the New York Times, checking the headlines. Headlines are lethal. You know, whatever you put in a headline is what sticks with people. And even if they somehow get around to part of the story somewhere down, you know, in the article, what people remember is the headline. And one of the examples, you know, when the rabbis were killed in the synagogue a year ago, you know, a lot of the headlines were so outrageous, you know, that the two Palestinians were killed in a synagogue. You know, that kind of thing is what you get. And you have no idea that they were the aggressors and that they were killed after they have hacked people to death.
Right. The horrific Har Nof attack. In fact, an initial report that came up, I think, on CNN, just one of these live reports that came up, the initial one said killed in mosque, and then that got corrected. Yeah, but that was one of the most horrific attacks of all, Jewish men praying in a synagogue, getting hacked to death and shot, and then the assailants, the terrorists, get shot by the police. In fact, one of the policemen, a Druze policeman, gets killed, and it gets reported, you know, five killed in attack, something like that.
Right.
So what, in your view, this is not just inaccurate. There's something behind it. There is an agenda. There's a mindset. So analyze it for me. What's actually going on here?
Well, you're right. It's the delegitimization of Israel currently, but it is based on at least more than 2,000 years. I am, from my perspective as a Christian and dealing with the Christian world, I always talk about 2,000 years of anti-Semitism, but it actually started before the Christian era. And anti-Zionism is nothing more than the new manifestation of anti-Semitism. Everything that is said about Israel has been said about Jews for over 2,000 years. Israel is the corporate Jew. That's all it is. And it's an extreme bias.
Yeah, saying it like that, Israel is the corporate Jew, and then pointing out the same libels, the same attacks, the same myths perpetuated against the Jewish people in the Middle Ages, when there was no issue of Zionism, no one could accuse them of taking someone's land. They were often impoverished and driven from place to place. The same things being said about them then are being said about Israel now. Even some of the cartoons that you see in Palestinian media mirror the cartoons that the Nazis used.
And you bring up the issue of land. You know, so many of the media outlets and pundits and people everywhere say, well, if Israel would just give up more land, there would be peace. Well, they've already tried that. They did that in Gaza, and look what's happened. Gaza just became a launching pad for missiles fired all the time, regularly, at Israeli citizens. The issue is not the land. The Jewish people living in the land before 1948 were also attacked and murdered by Arabs. The bottom line is the Arabs do not want the Jews there. It has nothing to do with the land. They don't want a two-state solution. They don't want to share the land. They want the Jews out.
Yeah, and ultimately, of course, that is the goal of Hamas, Palestinian Authority. Palestinian Authority may talk more about its two-state solution, but even then, Palestinian state would be, to use the old German word, would be Judenrein, would be free of Jews. So the Jews are happy to say, let's coexist together. We've got 1.5 million Arabs in our land. Let's live together. The Palestinians say no Jews in our land. You mentioned that this predates Christianity. Peter Schaefer, in his book Judeophobia, traces things back to Greco-Roman anti-Semitism. But if we look at the scriptural witness, you can go back to the book of Esther, which you focused on.
That's right, and that's why I did, because I wanted to address the history of anti-Semitism. Specifically, I wanted to target Christian anti-Semitism, but I needed to start at the beginning, and that is our oldest witness to it, is in Persia, about 400, 450 years before the Christian era, and the things that were said about the Jews then by the Greeks and the Romans just got carried through into the Christian era.
Yeah, and what are some of the things that are found in the Book of Esther against the Jews or Jerusalem?
Well, the point of my dissertation was to show that anti-Semitic interpretations of that story actually come from two Greek versions that were written after the Hebrew version. The original Hebrew version is what we have in our Hebrew Bible, But after that, there were two Greek versions that both of which made significant additions and changes. If you look at it on a text critical level, literally every verse in the Hebrew version has some change made by one or both of the Greek versions. Mm. And the additions in the Greek versions added things that the authors at the time thought were improving the story. They added the involvement of God. They added prayer. But they also changed the character of Esther and the character of the Jews to make Esther look more aggressive. They also changed the language in the edict. In chapter 3, the edict from Haman that says, you know, this is, we're going
to... Tell you what, I'm sorry to interrupt. We've got a break. We'll finish this on the other side of the break, and then let's talk about this conference coming up in California on Monday. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I'm speaking with my special guest, Tricia Miller, who is a senior research analyst for the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America. The acronym is CAMRA. Let me encourage you to take a few minutes and get online sometime today as soon as you have an opportunity and go to CAMRA.org, CAMRA.org. You will not find information about cameras there. You will find information from the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America. For example, I'm looking right here, one of the headline stories, New York Times tilts against Israel whenever it can. When was that written? Today. And you can see the latest misleading, biased reporting from the New York Times. Here's another one from 3 days ago, a tale of two LA Times headlines, attacks in West and Paris. So just how the LA Times will report Islamic violence in one part of the world versus Islamic violence against Jews in Israel, etc. So go there. It's an eye-opener. You'll find it disturbing, but it will help you to understand the importance of getting the truth out. Tricia, I do want to discuss the conference that is coming up, but you were finishing about the Book of Esther and how changes were made in the subsequent versions, not someone altering the Hebrew text, but the subsequent translations and versions. So why don't you just finish that?
Yeah, well, it is the changes in the Greek versions. The most important change is in the edict when Haman is given permission to have the Jews killed. And every verb that's in that edict is it's everything that describes what the Jews are allowed to do. They are allowed to defend themselves. That's all. The Jews were not given permission to take any offensive action. They were only allowed to defend themselves. And that's why this story is so analogous to the story of Israel today, because if no one had attacked the Jews in the time of Esther, no one would have died. Mm-hmm. The Jews killed people who came to kill them. And it's the same with Israel. Israel does not make aggressive moves to gain land. Everything that they've done has been defensive because they were being attacked.
And somehow Israel does not have the right to defend itself that other nations do. Tell our listeners about this conference. Everyone listening in California, or California's a big state, but close to the conference, hopefully you can attend, find out about it. So give us the details.
All right, it's on Monday, this coming Monday, Martin Luther King Day. It's from 9 to 6 in the morning. It's at Neiman Hall in West Hollywood. And we have a fantastic lineup of international speakers. They're scholars, they're religious leaders. We have Rabbi Adlerstein from the Simon Wiesenthal Center in L.A. also. And the purpose of the conference is to address the assault on evangelical support of Israel. Evangelicals have historically always stood with Israel, and that's exactly why they're now the target of a Palestinian narrative. It's a politically motivated crusade, actually. They're targeting American evangelicals for the purpose of winning spiritual and financial support for their political cause. They couch everything in a theological narrative to appeal to evangelicals, but it's a political cause and it's based on bad theology.
So who are some of the speakers? I was looking at the lineup and was duly impressed. Who are some of the speakers?
There's two of us from CAMRA. Also Lori Cardoza-Moore, who's the president of Proclaiming Justice to the Nations. She has done a lot of work in support of Israel. Shadi Kalul is coming from Israel. He's a captain in the IDF reserves, and he's an Aramean Christian who makes an outstanding case for what life is like in Israel as a Christian. How many more do you want? Each person is a highlight.
Right, absolutely. So let's address this issue then. The attack on support for Israel. The older generation saw the horrors of the Holocaust, if not firsthand. They grew up with that in very recent memory. The idea of the Jews having a homeland, this is wonderful. And, of course, the Jews are outmanned, outgunned. When there's a Jewish victory in Israel, it's a sign of the hand of God. It's a sign of God preserving his ancient people. Many Christians became more aware of the horrible history of anti-Semitism in church history. They wanted to renounce that. But now that Israel can be portrayed as the well-armed nuclear power Goliath, the Palestinians can be looked at as the poor victims. Obviously, we want to see justice for everyone. Palestinians suffer in many ways, and we're looking for a good solution for everyone. Obviously, there are radical Islamic ideologies that have to be overcome. But how do we regain a truthful, sympathetic narrative when now it's so easy to demonize Israel?
Well, we have to just keep putting out the facts, and we have to keep negating the falsehoods. And one of the things I do is continue to expose the theology that is driving this Palestinian narrative. It's a replacement theology. It's their own version, but replacement theology has been in existence for 2,000 years. Since the beginning of the church, there have been teachings within the church that the church, Christians, have replaced Israel and Jews in the purposes of God. If you read the Bible in standard scholarly methodology, that's not true. You could take, you know, as we know, anybody can take anything from the Bible and interpret it the way they want. But if you read everything in context in the Bible, it is not true that God is finished with Israel or the Jewish people. Israel, the 12 tribes, they're all represented all the way in the book of Revelation. So it has not changed. The expectation for the return to the land is in the Gospels. It's in the book of Acts. Jerusalem is still the center, you know, even in the book of Acts. So it's not true that this particular land is not significant in the Bible.
Yeah, on every front, absolutely. And when the disciples say to Jesus in Acts 1:6, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? And his response is, it's not for you to know the times and seasons the Father set by his own authority. Your job is to preach the gospel. That has been wrongly interpreted as if Jesus was saying to them, you fools, you idiots, there's a new era and the church has replaced Israel. Rather, he was affirming, great question. It's a valid question. It's just not for you to know right now. Here's what to focus on. Friends, you can find out more about this conference if they just go to the CAMRA website, or is there another website to go to?
There's an Eventbrite site. It's CAMRA, CAMERCA, .eventbrite.com. And that gives the whole program and more information about the speakers, and you can register at that site.
All right. Hey, friends, we're going to do a little bit bonus interview here with Tricia Miller on the other side of the break. That means many of you can just catch it by going to our website later today, Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown, and clicking on latest article. While you're on the website, remember to check out our special resource offer. It's me as a Jewish believer in Jesus interacting with the objections to Jesus with the rabbinic community with respect and honor. It is a 22-hour series, Countering the Counter-Missionaries, one of our most popular, and our resource department decided to cut the price in half this week, which we've never, ever done. So take advantage of that. You'll be blessed. You'll learn a lot. You'll learn to appreciate the Jewish people even more and see our different approaches to who Jesus is. Go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Time is short to take advantage of this.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Save the nation.
your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. My guest is Tricia Miller, and she is a senior research analyst for the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America, also known as CAMERA. Visit CAMERA.org. You'll be shocked by what you read, but then you'll be glad to know that people are holding the media accountable and calling on major newspapers, TV networks, etc., calling on them to report accurately about the Middle East. Tricia, why is it, in your view, that evangelical Christians on such a wide-ranging level have been so supportive of Israel for years, almost kind of a taken-for-granted thing, as it's being challenged now? But why do you think that support has been so deep?
Well, it's actually based on the historic support that has been since the beginning of the church, based on some of the scriptures that we were already talking about. A lot of the church has believed that Israel would be returned to the land in fulfillment of the prophecies. And the evangelical movement, a couple hundred years old, has picked that up, and they, you know, they just believe it scripturally because of what the Bible says, because of a literal interpretation of the Bible, where you get the other side is from an allegorical interpretation, and that's not the acceptable way to interpret the scriptures. So it's been a historic belief way before Israel became a state in 1948. Evangelicals saw that as a fulfillment of prophecy.
Right, and if you look at, be it a Charles Spurgeon in the 1800s or a Robert Murray McShane earlier in the 1800s, so one Presbyterian, one Baptist, and then in the 1600s, folks like John Owen, Puritan leaders, there has been this tradition. So you're tracing it back to a literal reading of Scripture, which means that if something is intended literally, we take it literally. It doesn't mean that we take poetry literally or an allegory literally, but if it's intended literally, it's taken as literally. Yet there are denominations, you can kind of watch them, they will shift, their moral standards will shift and become more in keeping with contemporary culture and less in keeping with Scripture. You'll also watch them shift when it comes to Israel. And it seems to be, again, the departing from the plain sense of Scripture.
Mm-hmm. It is. And wherever they read the word Israel in the Bible, they just automatically reinterpret that to mean the church because of replacement theology that the church has replaced Israel. So they assume that all the promises in the Bible for Israel are now the promises meant for the church, and that they don't have anything to do with Israel. Do I have a minute to talk about Palestinian version of this?
Please.
Okay. The Palestinians have crafted their own form of replacement theology. they make the outrageous claim that Palestinians are the indigenous people of the land.
Yep.
In other words, the Jews that are there now are of European descent. They only appeared there in the 19th century. Well, this serves their political purpose because then, obviously, if they're the rightful inhabitants of the land, the Jewish state is illegitimate. But this is, it's even more serious for Christians and Jews. This is very serious.
Yeah.
Because if they're the indigenous people of the land, the logical conclusion is Jesus was a Palestinian. He could not have been Jewish if there were no Jews in the land 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
This denial of the Jewishness of Jesus deconstructs the foundations of Christian faith by severing our faith from its Jewish roots. So this delegitimizes the Christian faith. It also is a danger for Jews because when Jesus is separated from his Jewishness, then we have the way paved, just as it was under the Nazis, we have the way paved for demonization, dehumanization of the Jewish people, just like the Nazis did with the Aryan Jesus.
Yeah, and in fact, there were German theologians, quote, Christian theologians, who wrote books saying that Jesus was not Jewish. This is more than handwriting on the wall, friends. These are dangerous lessons from history.
God of light, hear our cry, send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
A top Jewish leader in southern France has urged Jews in the region to refrain from wearing traditional headwear, refrain from wearing kippah, yarmulke, until better days. It comes after a Jewish teacher was injured in a machete attack by a Turkish teenager. For some years, I had read that many Jews in Berlin were concerned about wearing a yarmulke in public, wearing a kippah in public, because of the growing anti-Semitism in Berlin. These are increasingly dangerous times. Tricia, with what you do, being on the front lines with camera and seeing how much media bias there is, misreporting about Israel, can the tide be turned, and what role must the church play in turning the tide?
I would certainly hope that the tide could be turned, and I think that it can be if enough Christians get aware of the facts. They need to understand that the narrative that's being directed at the evangelical world is based on lies. It's based on fallacious charges of apartheid. It's based on rewritten history. It's based on this false theology. And we can turn this tide, and we can regain strong evangelical support for Israel. Most evangelicals will still say they support Israel, even if they don't know why. But they need to be informed, and they need to be willing to take action.
Right. So what kind of action can they take? A lot of people feel paralyzed. They feel helpless in terms of world events and things like that. Of course, Christians know they can pray, and there's nothing more important we can do than pray. But having prayed, what kind of steps can Christians take that are constructive to make a difference for Israel?
Well, if they're equipped with the facts, then they can confront error when they hear it. They may hear it in a sermon at church. They may see it in some Christian publication or in any publication. We have a tremendous team of letter writers with camera who, every time they see anything in one of their newspapers or magazines, wherever they live, they write letters to the editor, or they write to the author of the article to correct error. That's one very tangible thing they can do. But to be able to speak out in a church and to know why you believe what you believe is very important.
Yeah, and again, every little bit helps. Social media, the same thing. I mean, we're super active on social media, and that's a great place for people to get involved and dispel lies. What about the whole BDS movement, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel? Just looking at a New York Times article here that says that one denomination now in the States has put five Israeli banks on their on a blacklist. I mean, it's just madness. And this is the United Methodist Church now doing this. Five Israeli banks on a list of companies that it will not invest in for human rights reasons. What do people do about the whole BDS movement?
Well, again, people need to be educated to understand that the BDS movement actually hurts the Palestinians. The way it is presented is that this is the way you help the Palestinians by hurting Israel. And nothing could be farther from the truth, because Israel employs many, many Palestinians. The economy, the Palestinian economy, is supported and propped up in countless ways by Israel. And so when you take, if a business moves out of the so-called West Bank because they believe that they should do that, or they've been pressured to do that by BDS, it's Palestinians who lose jobs. Palestinians make 3 to 4 times more money when they work for an Israeli company than a Palestinian company. There's an extremely high level of unemployment in the Palestinian territories. They need the Israeli companies there to provide jobs.
Right. So the whole controversy over the soda company that the actress Scarlett Johansson was supporting, and it, Palestinians, they were very happy. They had good relationships with the Jewish company owners and the Jewish co-workers and things like that. And again, they were making more money. So to attack that company would be to attack the Palestinians. What about, though, the fact that there is so much fueling of intense Jewish hatred through radical Islamic ideology, And that permeates so much Palestinian culture. I know you're not focused primarily on influencing Palestinian thinking, but when you've got a state-run TV, in Gaza and under the Palestinian Authority, and so much of it, I mean, really just breeds hostility and hatred toward the Jewish people. Can these things be overcome anyway but relationally? Is there a solution there?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. Because you're dealing, like you said, you're dealing with the state-run institutions, and the fact that Palestinians are raised from the time they're born to hate Jews. They're taught that they're pigs and monkeys. They're taught that the best thing they can do is to die, as a jihadist. They're taught that they are born and raised to die in the battle against the Jews, in contrast to Jews who are born and raised to love life. So it's a very unbalanced battle that's going on, and it's hard. Unless there was a change in the way that children are brought up, I'm not sure how you can change it.
And that's so important for folks to hear, because as much as you hear about a Palestinian teenager, he's 13, he's 15, and he stabs a Jewish civilian in cold blood or another teenager in cold blood, of course, it's a murderous act, it's an inexcusable act, but that kid is a victim as well. He's guilty, he's responsible. But he's been raised a certain way. He has a certain mindset, and then whatever works out in his own life where he sees any type of inequality or any type of benefit for a Jewish person that he would have, that's only going to fuel his fire. That's also why it's important that if an Israeli is guilty of an atrocity, like the Jewish extremists that in retaliation for the death of Jewish teenagers, they went and killed Palestinians, killed a child, that has to be renounced just as clearly. And this has nothing to do with the values and ideals of Israel. And the Christian world needs to renounce it, too, in solidarity with Israel, to say this is not who the nation is.
That's right. And Israel has been, they've taken extreme measures to prosecute anyone that commits a crime, whether they're Jewish or whoever.
Exactly. So let's just go back in the couple minutes that we have. In the studies that you did, the Book of Esther, your PhD work, if you had to kind of summarize the findings, what do we learn historically from that?
Well, from historical Christian interpretation of the Book of Esther, I learned that it was very anti-Semitic. To be very brief, the summary of Esther in a lot of Christians' minds is the Jews like to kill people and then have a party and eat. And so the understanding of the verbs, again, in both of the edicts were self-defense, and that's the most important lesson from Esther, is that the Jews were targeted for annihilation. The king allowed them to defend themselves. The only people who were killed were those who came to kill them. And that's the important lesson to understand, and understand that that's how Israel operates as well.
And you know what's so fascinating when you talk about Israel is the corporate Jew. So the same blood libels that were thrown against the Jewish people in the days before there was a modern state of Israel, they're thrown against corporate Israel today. The thing that's so fascinating is I have seen radical Islamic attacks on Israel, and they point to the Book of Esther to show Jewish blood guilt. And look at this, especially in Persia and Iran. Look at this. The Jews are still, they were murdering our people then. They're murdering our people today. It's remarkable, isn't it?
Yes, it is. But they make it the storyline the way they need to have it to promote their cause.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Tell our listeners, again, if they want to find out about this event, if they are in California or anywhere near the L.A. area, just give us the details again, the website.
All right. The website is cameraca.eventbrite.com. The conference goes from 9 to 6 in the evening, and it's at the Neiman Hall in West Hollywood.
All right, so you've got that, and Bright is spelled B-R-I-T-E?
Yes.
Okay,
Thank you.
And then to find out more, to check what the media is saying, to get the facts, and then to help stand with it, you can then write your letter to the editor based on the information, or write to your school, meet with a teacher about textbook errors and things like that. Go to camera, C-A-M-E-R-A.org. Hey, Tricia, thanks so much for joining us and for the great work you're doing.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right, my joy. 866-348-7884 is the number to call. And I am going to get to a Jewish-related question or two on the other side of the break. This conference takes place on Monday, Martin Luther King Day. Martin Luther King said this, speaking at an annual convention of the Rabbinical Assembly in 1968, "The response of some of the so-called young militants does not represent the position of the vast majority of Negroes. There are some who are color-consumed, and they see a kind of mystique in blackness or in being colored, and anything non-colored is condemned. We do not follow that course." Then he said, "Peace for Israel means security, and we must stand with all our might to protect her right to exist, its territorial integrity, and the the right to use whatever sea lanes it needs. Israel is one of the great outposts of democracy in the world."
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown coming your way live from Huntsville, Alabama. If you're anywhere near Huntsville, join me tonight. I'll be speaking at the Rock Church. You may have to register. It's a conference, actually. But if you're nearby, maybe you can make it. Phone number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, not for the service tonight, but to get on the broadcast with me. And after a very productive, insightful interview with Tricia Miller from camera.org, we've got some time for Jewish-related questions. We go to Long Island, my stomping ground growing up. Tom, welcome to the Line of Fire.
How are you doing, Dr. Brown? I had a question. I'm a little bit confused. Is there such thing as a pure Jewish race, pure Jewish line?
Well, yes and no, meaning that there have always been others that have been brought in by intermarriage, like a Ruth in the Bible, someone like that. So
right.
People have intermarried with Jews and then continued to live among the people of Israel. I was just with a good friend in Texas last week, a former student, now a professor, and his wife is Japanese, but she has completely married into his faith. They are believers in Jesus, but they live as Jewish believers in Jesus, and their daughters identify as Jewish believers in Jesus. So they are fully part of the people of Israel, but you have Gentile blood being mixed with Jewish blood. The key thing is, if you have, let's say, a Jew who marries a Gentile and then becomes fully assimilated in the Gentile world, and the children are fully assimilated, and now all of the marriages from the generations after that are all Gentile, that person's Jewish blood is basically lost in that respect. In other words, they have now been assimilated into the sea of the Gentile world. But if it goes the other way, and if a Gentile marries into the Jewish world, and then becomes part of the Jewish community, and now the marriages and subsequent generations are all within the Jewish community, then that person has now just joined together with Israel. So there is an ethnic genealogical DNA trace that can be made that would trace Jewish people ultimately back to the Middle East, but it's been with intermarriage along the way. So it's pure, but it's not totally pure.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, your Jewishness is traced through your mother?
According to traditional Judaism, yes. According to the Bible, you could argue that it goes through the father, or that it goes through the father or the mother, as long as someone is raised in the context and framework of being a Jew. I'm Jewish through my mother and father, so there's no dispute of that. But according to a traditional Jew, Tom, Jewishness is traced through the mother. And they get that from the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, where when the Jews intermarried with Gentiles, they had to separate from the women they married, and the children stayed with the mothers. But that doesn't prove that Jewishness goes through the mother. It just would be that the mothers would be the ones caring for the children in the ancient world, and it would be most practical in that regard. And the marriages themselves were sinful, so everything had to be severed. You can make an argument, for example, that out of the foreign wives that Solomon had, no one questioned whether the children of those foreign wives were Israelites or not, so that it came through the father. So you could make an argument either way. What I agree with is if you're Jewish through either your mother or father and have been raised to identify as a Jew and continue to identify as a Jew, you should be accepted as a Jew.
But the interesting thing, though, is that, you know, as tradition has it, when you marry, the wife takes the woman takes the man's name, last name.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
So yeah, in our culture, yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's not every culture, though.
Yeah, I mean, some cultures you don't change the last name, but the woman would still become more part of the father's family than the father part of the mother's family, if you had to say it like that.
You know, I had gotten to this whole thing because I was checking the genealogy when you get into Jeconiah, when God cursed his line, and that was for 10 generations.
Well, it doesn't say for 10 generations. It just...
Well,
it
no,
just,
sorry, after 10 generations, the curse is now lifted.
No, actually, you can make an excellent case that the curse is lifted in the days of his grandson, Zerubbabel, and that you get from the end of Haggai, the second chapter, that it uses language to indicate the curse is reversed. You can even make a case that it was reversed in his lifetime because the end of Jeremiah 52 tells us that God raises Jehoiakim up, Jeconiah, raises him up, and he sits at the king's table. That would indicate, this has been my view for many years and many rabbinic commentators, that indicated that he repented, and because he repented, God had mercy and restored him. And we see numerous examples of that in Scripture where God brings judgment when someone genuinely repents, the judgment is reversed. But for sure, it is clearly laid out in Haggai 2. Jeremiah 22 says, even though Jeconiah was like a signet ring on God's hand, God would cast him off. Haggai 2, God says that he's going to put his servant Zerubbabel, who represents the line of David, as a signet ring on his hand. So it seems there that the curse is reversed. Hey, one last thing, Tom. If you look in Acts, the 16th chapter, you'll see there that Paul has Timothy circumcised. And when there was pressure on him to have Titus circumcised, he said no, he refused. We see that in Galatians, the second chapter. Why? Titus was a Gentile. What about Timothy? Well, according to Acts chapter 16, it says this. He was the son of a certain Jewish woman, but his father was Greek. And there was dispute. Is he a Gentile or is he a Jew? So because his mother was Jewish, Paul had him circumcised. But that would indicate that there was dispute at that time. Are you Jewish because of your mother or because of your father? Paul said, fine, mother's Jewish. We'll circumcise you. We'll get rid of the doubt. Hey, thanks for the question. Much appreciated. Friends, you'll find a ton of practical, eye-opening information, even insights into Jewish understanding of Scripture and traditional Jewish interpretation of Scripture and Jewish understanding of the oneness of God, how that interfaces with Trinity, how we even use Jewish literature to help Jewish people understand the Messiah's divine nature and God's triunity. You'll find tremendous eye-opening information in my course, 22 Hours, Countering the Counter-Missionaries. I could teach this at a seminary and people would pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars to take a class like this. We have it at a very inexpensive price, but we've cut the price in half this week. So take advantage of this. There's an audio download, or you can get CDs or DVDs, all at half price, Countering the Counter Missionaries. There's nothing out like it. And we want to bless you this week at a tremendously reduced price. This week only. So go to my website to find out more. Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Askdrbrown.org. And remember, this Monday, Dr. James White will be giving a lecture at Fire Church right near Charlotte Motor Speedway. What every Christian needs to know about Islam. That's Monday night, January 18th. My bottom line today, there is an urgent need for the church to recapture what Scripture says about God's promises to Israel and to stand with the Jewish people today. Have you heard about the latest round between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama? That and a lot more today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, this one was a surprise to me. But did you hear that there is talk that President Obama wants to be the General Secretary of the UN? That when he's finished with being president, he wants to take the place of Ban Ki-moon, the current General Secretary. And guess who is opposing it vocally, strongly already? Yes, Prime Minister Netanyahu and some other Arab nations with him, according to what I've read. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. This is Michael Brown. I am coming your way live from Huntsville, Alabama. We'll be broadcasting today and tomorrow in the midst of a conference here. So your questions are completely welcome, but here's the parameter that you have to stay within, or here are the parameters. It's got to be Jewish related. What does that mean? Well, it could be about Jewish people, Jewish tradition, Judaism. Could be about Israel, the Middle East, even Islam because of the close connection there. It could be related to the Hebrew language, biblical, traditional developments over the centuries. It could be related very specifically Old Testament or Messianic prophecy kind of question, or Jewish objections to Jesus being the Messiah. That's what we cover on Thursday with Q&A, and then Friday as more anything goes with Q&A, 866-34-TRUTH. And I do want to talk about some of the myths about the Hebrew language. I brought these up before, and there's always going to be something to talk about with this, but it's just grievous to me. I've been studying Hebrew seriously since 1973. My PhD is in Near Eastern languages and literature, so this has been a major focus of mine for decades. Doesn't mean that everything I say is right. Doesn't mean that I can't be challenged. It means that I do have expertise in this. Somebody challenged me on Facebook the other day, and the vast majority of Facebook comments, posts, I can't respond to because can't even see them because the amount of them, let alone have the time to respond. And it's not my primary goal to be responding there. We'll post our posts, make our comments, put up our videos and articles, and then let others have their discussion. But someone challenged me directly, what do I have my doctorate in? So sent him a link that just gave him the information. And he said, then how can you be so ignorant of Islam? If you've got a PhD in these related languages, how can you be so ignorant about Islam? So I thought, well, let's make this a teachable moment here. So I reached out to the person and said, well, I've studied Quran and Arabic. I've studied side by side with sincere Muslims. I have friends who live in the Muslim world. And I've lost family members to radical Islam. Or loved ones to family members and loved ones to radical Islam. My wife's brother Douglas was killed in 9/11 terror attacks. One of our spiritual sons working in the Middle East was assassinated a few years ago by Al-Qaeda terrorists. And many Muslims, millions of Muslims, hundreds of millions renounced that terror. I understand that. Anyway, so I just laid that out, and he comes back with another comment. I said, well, just how many years have you spent studying Islam? How many years have you spent studying these issues? And how many Muslims do you know closely? How many years have you lived in the Middle East, or do you have friends, or and on and on? So he writes back saying, and I think he was like a delivery driver for a pizzeria or a pizza company. That doesn't mean he's not a scholar of Islam, but just maybe a little unlikely. So I'm telling him, I'm saying what I'm saying based on knowledge. I'm saying what I'm saying based on knowledge. So his response is, yeah, but look, there are far more people in America killed by cops. Like, oh, gosh. So anyway, talk about exposing ignorance. So anything where I have any area of expertise, I am glad to help. 866-34-TRUTH. Now, we come back. I want to talk about some of the crazy myths you hear about Hebrew. Stay with us.
Fire we please, send the fire. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back to our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast, 866-34-TRUTH. Any Jewish-related question you have, we will gladly take. Before I get to your calls, someone just posted this. I tweeted out a little while ago, having studied Hebrew seriously since 1973, it grieves me to see people who don't know the language spread strange myths about it online. By the way, to connect with me on Twitter, that's Dr. Michael L. Brown, Dr. Michael L. Brown. Make sure you get the two L's in the middle there. So at Dr. Michael L. Brown to connect with me on Twitter, to connect with me on Facebook. Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown on Facebook. So someone then tweeted back, yeah, like the myth about monster energy drinks and using a satanic code in Hebrew. Yeah, that one's so crazy. It was hardly even on my list because no one claimed it was scholarly. So this is the claim. Monster brand energy drink uses a Hebrew version of 666 in their logo. So if you go to Snopes.com, it's getting refuted. There, of course, it's completely false. It's nonsense. I just watched a video on Facebook of a lady discussing all the satanic symbolism on Monster energy drink cans. The M is made of three Hebrew symbols for the number 6, so 666. And there's a cross in the O. That is witchcraft, because when you tip the can, it's an upside-down cross. And then it mentions, well, a derogatory term for attractive women who are married. Hence, the can is not Christian, as the cross suggests at first sight. The three lines that are supposedly the Hebrew symbols for the number 6. That's the M logo. That's what the big M is supposed to look like. It is not Vav, Vav, Vav in Hebrew, and then 666. It's a big M. Oh, gosh. People believe this nonsense. 866-34-TRUTH. Oh, I got a bunch more I'll get into with you. Let's grab a couple of calls. We'll start in Durham, North Carolina. Daniel, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've heard a lot of things over the years about the original Hebrews. Like recently, I heard someone say that many of the cities in Africa, their original names are from the Hebrew language. I was curious about your take on that subject.
Yeah, the whole idea that the original Hebrews were black, and that the Middle Eastern Hebrews are imposters, let alone European Jews and American Jews. You know, I'd be called an imposter Jew. It's complete nonsense. There's no historical scholarship behind it. It's not to say that there were not black-skinned people among the ancient Hebrews. We read about Moses marrying an Ethiopian woman, would presumably have been a black woman, an African woman, in Numbers, the 12th chapter. But where there's an African presence, or it's normally noted, or someone would be referenced in those particular terms. And you have verses like in Lamentations, you know, your princes were as white as snow. And it's talking about, just a description of them and how they lived and so on. But Lamentations 4:7, her princes were brighter than snow, purer than snow, whiter than milk. Their bodies were more ruddy, so red than coral. So even a description like that would indicate that you're not looking at blacks or Africans. There are some African tribes that trace themselves back to ancient Israel, just like you have some groups in India. And from what we can tell, if you go back far enough, there is a connection. But then there was extensive intermarriage with the people in India or the people in Africa. Hence, they now look just completely like Indians or completely like Africans. If there are cities in Africa whose name goes back to the Bible, then that would probably be under some Christian influence. The idea that you can trace it back before then, for the most part, is just completely bogus. The other thing is, let's remember that Islam is based on the Arabic language. Arabic and Hebrew are sister languages. They have many words, phrases, concepts in common. And the Muslim world expanded greatly into Africa. So certain names and traditions could even go back to Islam and have no connection whatsoever to the Hebrew Bible. But for the most part, you can just dismiss this stuff as nothing more than myths. And you can see the manifestation of it in the ugliness that it has towards Jewish people. Those groups that teach this, black Israelites, the black Hebrews, are often militant, say that the white man is the manifestation of Satan, and are often militantly anti-Jewish, anti-Israel. So it exposes the spirit behind the myth as well.
Okay, thanks, sir.
You are very welcome. 866-34-TRUTH. Before I go back to the phones, did you hear that the name Barack Obama was found in the Bible? Look, I'm not a fan of our president. I'm grieved over many of his views and policies. You know that. And I'm not going to demonize him and then come up with some ridiculous myth about his name. But no, we were told in Luke chapter 10, where Jesus says, "I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven," that the word lightning in Hebrew, that's Barak. And heaven, well, it's not Shamayim, but from on high, that could be Bama, a high place. And if you put the word "and" in there, ooh, Bama. So it was Barak ooh, Bama, and Jesus was speaking Aramaic. That is complete nonsense. That is complete idiotic, ridiculous nonsense. Nothing more than nonsense. I had to reach out to a website couple of years ago that posted, I said, please pull it. First, the name Barak is normally associated with not Barak lightning, no, but with the verb Barak, which means to bless. And in Arabic, it would be pronounced slightly differently. Hence, we get Barak. So most scholars trace the name to that, a totally different root. Some have argued that it was named after a horse of Muhammad called Barak, you know, fast as lightning. They argued that even so, it's got no connection to lightning whatsoever. And then you would not use the word Bama for heaven. And you would allegedly, even the very best with the ridiculous reconstruction, you end up with, this is what you end up with, you end up with lightning and high place, which has nothing to do with Jesus saying, "I saw lightning fall from heaven." And then Jesus was not speaking Aramaic to prophesy the name of an American king. Oh, gosh. Can't we let the Bible say what it says and rejoice in that when it tells us so much that we need to know for life and godliness? Why must we create these ridiculous myths? It just makes us all look stupid. 866-34-TRUTH. You say, yeah, but if we don't know Hebrew, how can we know any better? Just ignore the nonsense, because that's not how the Bible works. That's not how the Bible works. That you have to reconstruct it and go back to the original language and then reconstruct it from there and then end up with a ridiculous thing that's supposed to be a prophecy of something taking place that maybe it's going to tell us it's going to win the Super Bowl. No, the Bible doesn't do that. 866-34-TRUTH. Boy, all of our callers, I'm looking at North Carolina. All right, let's stay in North Carolina. Winston-Salem, Tim, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown.
You're welcome.
My question is coming from a scripture that says the Jews require a sign to believe. And my question is, would that still apply today? Would the Lord perform a sign or a miracle to an unbelieving Jew to get them to believe before he would an unbelieving Gentile?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. In point of fact, Paul preached to Gentiles as well, and he preached in signs, wonders, and miracles so that their faith would rest in the power of God, not the wisdom of men. Read that, for example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. So right after saying Jews require a sign, he talks about Gentiles being moved by God's miraculous display. So the gospel always came with signs, wonders, and miracles. The sign that the Jews were requiring is, okay, demonstrate that you're the Messiah. You know, give us some type of supernatural act, which Jesus was not willing to do. And the Greeks, they wanted some type of, you know, esoteric wisdom and philosophy. And Paul said, no, we preach the Messiah. But when we preach the Messiah, that's when the power of God is revealed. So in that sense, no, Jews don't need a sign any more than anyone else. And when we preach the gospel and the power of the Spirit, that's what they need. Coming under conviction of sin, recognizing God's living power, and being transformed. And that's the same for Jew or Gentile. Great question. Thank you.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, Israel is not happy. They are not happy with the Swedish Foreign Minister Margot Wallström's comments. She has said a lot of inflammatory things against Israel in recent months. Two days ago, she called for a probe to determine if Israel was guilty of extrajudicial killings of Palestinians during recent violence. In response, Israel's foreign ministry said that Wallström was giving support to terror and thus encouraging violence, calling her statements irresponsible and delusional. December of last year, she criticized Israel before the Swedish parliament for what she claimed were extrajudicial executions of Palestinian attackers. So in other words, the Palestinians attack a Jewish person, maybe they're shot and they survive, although Israel just kill them, and actually accusing them of doing that. Not in the course of the battle where the person's attacking, you shoot them dead, but you shoot them, they survive, and then you just kill them. When asked by a Swedish parliamentarian why she refused to condemn Palestinian acts of violence against Israelis, she replied that while she did not condone terrorism, quote, at the same time, the Israeli response doesn't need to be disproportionate force. Israel has now said to her, you're not welcome. You are not welcome in our country. Oh, and by the way, how has Hamas been using the funds that have poured into them for the rebuilding of their cities and the rebuilding of their villages, the rebuilding of their hospitals and schools after the disastrous war against Israel? Rebuilding tunnels, rebuilding terror tunnels. It's a large part of where the money has gone. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, let me take another call or two, then I want to get back to some more myths about the Hebrew language. Let's go to Lee in Fouquay-Varina in North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brown. I just got turned on to you last month. Hadn't heard you before. I believe that you're the voice for the voice of God in these days. But my question concerns Genesis 49:10.
Yeah.
You know, where it says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh come. I've condensed it, but I don't have every translation, but I have several translations. King James, it seems like that's the only one that uses the word Shiloh. I'll hang up and let you expound, but I'm just kind of concerned what your thoughts on that. Thank you very much, sir.
You got it. Thanks for the kind words, and obviously it's my goal to be your voice and to be a voice of moral, cultural, spiritual revolution. Thank God for the many good voices that are out there. Okay, so Genesis 49:10. It is a messianic prophecy for sure, even though there is dispute about the meaning of one key phrase. I say it's clearly a messianic prophecy because on all accounts, it does speak of leadership, authority, not passing from Judah until someone comes or something happens. And then it says it is to he whom the peoples will obey, all right? So the question is, what about this Shiloh thing? It says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. Ad ki yavo Shiloh. What does that mean in Hebrew? And the obedience of the peoples is his. The homage of the peoples is his. So it is telling us that there will be a leader who comes, and that there will be leadership in Judah until that leader comes, so presumably from the tribe of Judah, and to him the nations will give homage. So it is speaking of a worldwide reign of a leader from Judah, hence understood rightly as a messianic prophecy. So you could translate it as Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh, meaning until Shiloh comes. And Shiloh is a name of the Messiah, and perhaps associated with the word for rest, a man of rest. Again, somewhat speculation. Some have read it as Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh, until it comes to Shiloh, meaning that Judah would be the lead tribe until they settled with the Ark in Shiloh. Well, that's ridiculous, because the leadership was established during that time and afterwards and continued for centuries. So that doesn't work. Another would be to understand Shiloh as meaning Shiloh, tribute to him. Ad Ki Yavo Shiloh, until the one to whom tribute belongs. And that's how some translations understand it. So I'll just look here. King James, New King James say until Shiloh comes. ESV, until tribute comes to him. NIV, until he to whom it belongs shall come. HCSB, until he whose right it is comes. And they have a capital H there, which is really being interpretive. Complete Jewish Bible, until he comes to whom obedience belongs. NET, until he comes to whom it belongs. NLT, which is a slight paraphrase, until the coming of the one to whom it belongs. NRSV, until tribute comes to him. New Jewish Translation, so that tribute shall come to him. And the Septuagint, the ancient Greek translation, until there come the things stored up for him. So all that to say, we're not entirely clear. We're not entirely clear as to what it means, but it does clearly seem to be a messianic prophecy, and that leadership would continue in Judah until he came. And some have argued to say, well, how far can that go back? It certainly has not continued today. It hasn't continued through the centuries, so there's a time limit on it. And certainly after the destruction of the Second Temple, you couldn't argue for leadership continuing through Judah. And even right up to the Second Temple, it becomes disputable. So some would argue based on that, that the Messiah had to have come before the destruction of the Second Temple. You can't argue really strongly from Genesis 49:10 to that effect, but it is a contributing argument, and it does point to the Messiah not just leading Israel, but leading the nations as well. I hope I helped rather than confused. All right. I've got some Hebrew questions waiting. We'll come to them right on the other side of the break. 866-348-7884. Also, some sober words about ISIS. I want you to hear from a former intelligence director in the United States so that we can pray with more focus and more faith and pray for our government to act with wisdom as well. This week's special offer is a thoroughly Jewish offer as well. The most comprehensive resource you will find on countering the counter-missionaries, either in audio or video form. It's my 22-hour class, Countering the Counter-Missionaries. We'll take you through the major Jewish objections to Jesus being the Messiah. In doing so, you'll go on a journey of discovery as we open up the scriptures. I mean, you will be amazed. As we open up the scriptures, as you gain insight, as you see Jewish background, as you understand Jewish thought as it relates to the Bible, you'll see things in a light you've never seen before. Absolutely fascinating. And to the extent you're interacting with Jewish people, you'll find this absolutely invaluable. And if you're a believer struggling with these issues themselves, all the more. Well, we have reduced the course to a very low price to start, a 22-hour course that you could pay many hundreds of dollars for to take. We've reduced it to start, but we've cut the price in half. We're almost giving it away this week. Trust me. Go to Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. Order today. You can do an audio download, or you can order the CD or the DVD. Half price.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution.
Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Who said it? I think we do not attach a sufficient importance to the restoration of the Jews. We do not think enough of it, but certainly, if there is anything promised in the Bible, it is this. Who said that? Charles Spurgeon. Who said this? I will insist the Hebrews have contributed more to civilized men than any other nation. If I was an atheist and believed in blind eternal fate, I should still believe that fate had ordained the Jews to be the most essential instrument for civilizing the nations. The most glorious nation that ever inhabited this earth, the Romans and their empire, were but a bubble in comparison to the Jews. Who said that? John Adams. John Adams. How about this? The New Testament clearly affirms the salvation of literal Israel. Who said that? Professor, New Testament scholar George E. Ladd. What do you know? Some great Israel quotes. 866-34-TRUTH. Do you have a Jewish-related question for me? A Hebrew-related question for me? A modern Israel-related question? We'll cover them. We'll answer your questions today on the Line of Fire. Before I go to the phones, let me mention a myth that came up in a call last week. Let me address it again. In Hebrew, perhaps earlier this week, in Hebrew, you have something called a direct object marker. Direct object is when you use the in front of something. So if I say, I am getting in a car, that is indirect object, right? A car, the car is object, a car, indirect. I said, I'm getting into the car, that's direct object. So when you have the word the in front of the object, that's called direct object. When you don't have the before it, or if you just have a before it, then that's indirect object. So Hebrew does not have the equivalent of the word a, but it does have the word the. And when you are having, say, a verb followed by the object, and it is a direct object, so God created the heavens and the earth, you have what's called a direct object marker. And in Hebrew, it's et, which is composed of an aleph, the first letter of the alphabet, and a tav, the last letter of the alphabet. It's just a direct object marker. It has no meaning. You don't translate it. Everyone who knows Hebrew knows it has no meaning. Modern Hebrew speakers use it the same. It is simply to say what follows is direct object, and then that's confirmed by the form that follows. Now, Aramaic has a similar form, but it's yat. Yat is the same thing. You don't translate it. It is a direct object marker. So Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, Bereshit bara, in the beginning God created, Bereshit bara Elohim, et the heavens and et the earth. Et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. You don't translate et. It has no meaning. Some say, oh no, actually it has a very significant meaning, because et, that's like A and Z, that's Aleph and Tav, that's Alpha and Omega, that's beginning and the end. That's talking about the Messiah. That's talking about God. Nonsense. Complete, utter, sheer nonsense. It is just the direct object marker and nothing less, nothing more. That's all that it is. Don't let anyone tell you all these silly things about Hebrew and discover things that don't exist. If you want to have a play on words, have fun with the text and make it mean what you want, then use a phone book instead, because at least you're not tampering with Scripture. We'll be back with your calls.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Whoever is thirsty, let him come. Whoever wishes, let him come and take from the waters of life.
Welcome back to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-348-7884. Let us go right back to the phones, and we'll go back to North Carolina. Durham, William, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Brown. Quick question. I was just wondering about the repetitiveness in Hebrew literature, like when God spoke to Moses and, well, going back before that, Abraham, when he may call his name and say, Abraham, Abraham, or when God says, Moses, Moses, and he does that throughout the Old Testament, and when Jesus says, you know, does the same thing. And I was wondering, what is the, is there any, now how does that, I can't think of the words, but what is that in Hebrew literature, and what is a good source where I may read up on something like that?
That's really just emphasis. In other words, there are things, William, that are really specific Semitic style. For example, Hebrew parallelism, where you'll have idea A expressed in the first half of the verse and then a contrasting idea in the second half, or an idea that builds on the second half, that, you know, the first half says this, and then the second half, what's more is this, a certain contrast, things like that. That would be more in the Semitic style of things. As far as just Moses, Moses, Abraham, Abraham, that would be emphasis for getting attention. In my view, it's not specifically Hebrew or Semitic as much as an obvious way of getting someone's attention, make sure they're listening. That could theoretically take place in any language. If you're looking for something in terms of a book that tells you about Hebrew language or Hebrew style, here's the struggle, to be honest, is to think of something that's more simple. You know, that's the challenge. Boy, what would be a simple thing that tells you? I'm looking at some bogus things here. You know, the history of the Hebrew language or something like that. I mean, this is a fairly academic work. There's one called The History of the Hebrew Language on Helsans Badilos. That's just going to tell you a lot of fascinating things about Hebrew. There's another one that I'm not as familiar with, called In the Beginning, A Short History of the Hebrew Language. And that is written by Joel Hoffman, Hoffman. In the Beginning, A Short History of the Hebrew Language. You might find that helpful. Again, a lot of these things are technical and harder to understand. But thank you. I appreciate the call. 866-34-TRUTH. Stay in North Carolina for another moment. Chris in Winston-Salem, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brand, how you doing?
Really well, thank you.
Listen, my question, and again, I just want to make this so I don't think I'm trying to predict when Christ returns or anything like that. But I've been studying a lot of Hebrew and a lot of Jewish as far as the Lord's feast days. And when Christ says, no man knows the day nor the hour, not even the Son of Man, not even the angels in heaven, but only the Father. And Peter asked him, and he said, Lord, is this for us or for everyone? So it's almost acts like he knows what he understood what he was saying. Was it actually a Jewish idiom letting him know that the day and the hour refers to the Feast of Trumpets 1 year, probably on the end of a 7-year sabbatical cycle, and only the Father knows refers to an ancient Jewish wedding as the Father was the only one that knew.
That's complete myth, 100% myth. For sure.
But none of that has anything.
Okay. No, it's a complete myth, modern internet myth. when the disciples say, is this for us, for everyone, he's talking about being ready for the Lord's return. And he's been talking sometimes to the crowds and then sometimes taking them, his disciples aside and saying, hey, this is for you to know. The others aren't going to know it. So that was their question. Is this for us to know? Is this for others? But no, that's a complete myth. No substance to it whatsoever. And for sure, the Feast of Tabernacles points towards the final ingathering of the nations and points towards the day when all the nations, according to Zechariah 14, will come to Jerusalem to worship the God of Israel then after the Messiah returns and set up his kingdom. So it does have an end of the world image, as well as pointing back to Israel dwelling in the wilderness. So in short, the Messiah is crucified at the time of Passover. He rises in conjunction with first fruits. He sends his spirit at Pentecost, Shavuot, the Feast of Weeks. His return coincides with the trumpet blast. So this is now a few months later, the first day of the seventh month on the biblical calendar. His return is with the sound of a trumpet, so the Feast of Trumpets, which leads to national salvation of Israel, hence the Day of Atonement, and then the final ingathering of the nations, Feast of Tabernacles. So the feasts do have prophetic and what we call eschatological meaning, but no, that's a complete myth that you heard there. You can dismiss it. Don't even need to trouble yourself 30 more seconds with it. I can assure you of that. 866-34-TRUTH. Richmond, Virginia. Bill, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Brown. Thanks for taking my call. This is something I'm concerned about in interpretation. There's a very well-known teacher who I very much respect, Hank Hennegraaff, and his take a lot on the Book of Daniel. And, you know, where it talks about the abomination that causes desolation, he believes that was Antiochus Epiphanes, and that a lot of these prophecies, or most of them, have been fulfilled. And in light of that, it just, sometimes it comes across to me as almost, I don't want to say anti-Semitic, that seems kind of strong, but almost borderlines on kind of a replacement theology. I just want to know
Hank is an esteemed colleague. His ministry does a tremendous amount of good and has for many years. We've had differences over the years on different issues having to do with revival and things like that. We'd have a very, very deep difference about Israel today. And I'd love to have public dialogue with Hank over this, but I don't think his desire is to be combative or to have a debate, but I would welcome a public dialogue. I think it could be very, very helpful. But if that's not what he desired, the last thing I'd want to do is put pressure on him. But yeah, categorically, I differ. It's abundantly clear that, yes, certain things did happen with the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, but most did not happen. We are not in a new heaven and new earth where there's no more death or pain or sorrow. The resurrection of the dead has not yet taken place, where we are in glorified bodies that will never die. Jesus has not yet returned in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who don't know God and establishing his kingdom on the earth where there's no more war. These things have absolutely not happened. And the promises to Israel on a national level remain fixed and remain sure, as surely as God is God. In fact, he puts his reputation on it in Jeremiah 31, verses 35 to 37. To say that Israel now is to be spiritually interpreted, or that it was always spiritually interpreted, or that it just refers to the believers within the nation, or that in some way the church is the new Israel, I categorically differ with that idea that the church is the new Israel. And it's clear to me that it is only God who brought the Jewish people back to the land. If the Jewish people were scattered under divine judgment, if in fact the Jewish people were scattered under divine judgment, then what God curses, no one can bless. What God blesses, no one can curse. When God opens the door, no one can shut it. When he shuts the door, no one can open it. If God scatters in his wrath, no one can regather. How then have millions of Jews been regathered to the land? How has the land been reestablished? How have these things happened? If God didn't do it, Satan doesn't have the power to do it. People don't have the power to do it. There is no explanation. God has kept his word, just as he said, that he would scatter us around the world, that we have suffered much, that we would be disciplined, that we would not be destroyed, that we would be regathered even in a state of unbelief. And there in the land, God would sprinkle clean water upon us and begin to purify us and cleanse us. We are seeing that happen in Israel as God continues to open up the hearts and minds of his people to Jesus the Messiah. So, yes, I am very much concerned over these things. My friend Hank would have guests on his show, like Gary Burge from Wheaton and others, who would absolutely have a pro-Palestinian narrative to the point that it could even be and seem and feel anti-Israel, and to some, seem or feel anti-Semitic. I'm sure that Hank is not an anti-Semite. According to everything I know about him, he does have real issues with modern Israel today, so we do have very sharp differences. He remains a friend and esteemed colleague in the midst of those differences. And if there is an opportunity to explore them, to dig into the word together in a public or private setting, I gladly welcome that. Thank you, sir, for the call.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
In the mind of ISIS, its global caliphate would extend to the United States of America itself. ISIS has gained affiliates faster than Al-Qaeda ever did. From nothing a year ago, there are now militant groups in nearly 20 countries that have sworn allegiance to ISIS.
That was the voice of former acting CIA director Michael Morell testifying to the House Armed Services Committee a couple of days ago. And he said, we've not faced the likes of it before. It is a significant strategic and lethal threat to the United States of America. It envisions a global caliphate that would, quote, extend to the United States of America itself. Now, interesting, here's another voice. This is Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Ya'alon. He met on Thursday with U.S. Undersecretary of Defense Robert Work, according to Israel's Army Radio. And according to the report, this U.S. defense official said, quote, Israel is a cornerstone in our policy and strategy in the Middle East. If you want to help fight Islamic terror, you stand with Israel. 866-348-7884. That's one of many reasons to be standing with Israel. It doesn't mean everything Israel does is right or perfect, but it means we believe God brought them back to the land and established them there. It means that we believe in God's eternal purposes for Israel and that Israel is a democracy and our ally in the Middle East. And from a church perspective, because of the church's many sins against the Jewish people through the centuries, this is a way of us saying, here's what real Christians do and believe as we stand with Israel. And then we can have the Palestinians' best interest in mind as well. All right, if you are listening to me anywhere in North Carolina and can get to Charlotte area this coming Monday night, January 18th, Martin Luther King Day, maybe you've got a free day, you've got some extra time to drive, there will be a lecture delivered by my friend and colleague, top apologist James White, Dr. James White, on what every Christian needs to know about Islam. What every Christian needs to know about Islam, followed by Q&A. It's free. We'll receive an offering to help support Dr. White's ministry. But this Monday night, January 18th, it's going to be at Fire Church in Concord, right next to the Speedway. So you know where Charlotte Motor Speedway is. You hard to miss it. You pass it on your right, and on the same side of the road where the Speedway is, less than a half mile down, you'll see Fire Church. Join us this Monday night. And then, again, to all my friends in greater North South Carolina, 2 weeks from today, January 28th, our first ever Night to Ignite Vision Banquet. The Benham Brothers will be speaking. We've got a great free meal for you. I'll be bringing you a word of inspiration. Seats are limited and are going fast. This is going to be an intimate gathering with no more than 150 people. That's the max. Seats are going quickly. We need you to RSVP. And on this night, we will let you know what God's put in our hearts, the vision in our hearts, and how you can partner together with us so that you can be involved in things that can really rock the nation and touch the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So join us January 28th. How do you find out more? Go to Night to Ignite, nighttoignite.com. Did you get that? nighttoignite.com. You can register there, but we need to know if you're coming. So please RSVP as soon as possible. Let's go to Gastonia. Dino, welcome to the Line of Fire.
How are you today, brother?
Doing very well, thank you.
I'd just like to say and tell everybody that in the past 5 years alone, Israel has brought out so many advancements in technological stuff and medical things, and some aren't even allowed over here yet.
Yeah, it's amazing. A small country with, what, about 6 million Jews and about 1.5 million Arabs, so 7.5 million living in Israel proper, and then the, quote, disputed territories, West Bank and Gaza adds almost doubles that number. But what Israel's produced is mind-boggling, incredible amount of technology. There's a great little internet video, Dino, that says, before you boycott Israel, it's basically think twice, you know, because your cell phone runs by Israeli components and your computer operates by them. And then all these, I mean, they've got these robots that can go into your bloodstream, the tiny robots go in your bloodstream, perform some operation and come out. I mean, amazing stuff, developments in cancer research and on and on. The list of Nobel laureates coming from Israel and, as you say, medical scientific advances, it's really mind-boggling.
It is. And just one more quick thing. President Jimmy Carter recently announced that he was cancer-free, and one of the main drugs he used and needed came from Israel.
Really?
Yes. And I would urge anybody out there to write their congressmen, senators, and to the FDA, and to get them to release the new scoliosis procedure and medicines and therapies they have now in Israel. They're just amazing. They invented a ceramic ratchet that attaches to the spine, and 3 weeks after the surgery, the patient goes into a therapy, and a ratchet actually clicks the spine back into space. It's unbelievable.
Wow. You know, Dino, of course, I was glad to hear the news of President Carter being declared, the battle with cancer and how he was handling it. And then, of course, the good news in terms of positive results right now. I didn't know the Israel connection. And if accurate, it's all the more ironic because he's called Israel an apartheid state and has been considered one of our most anti-Israel presidents.
Hasn't he, though? That's very hypocritical. I mean, he's supposed to be a Christian.
Yeah, well, listen, you know, you get this idea you're siding with justice when you side against Israel with the Palestinians. You buy into a false narrative. It's out there. The first hour, I had a great guest talking about that. For more info, folks can go to camera, C-A-M-E-R, camera.org. Yeah, I'm. Thank you for the call, Dino. I'm looking at this. The miniature ratchet mechanism has successfully been implanted in 15 patients so far. That's wild. Argo Medical Technologies Rewalk Robotic Exoskeleton. From what was featured on the TV hit show Glee and enabled paraplegic runners in London and Tel Aviv to be able to, to complete marathons. Wow. All right, friends, I am just about out of time. Let's see. Maybe I can grab one more call quick. Robert in Portland, dive right into your question, sir.
Yes. How do you understand the term Son of God found that we find in the New Testament, but in the context of the Torah or Tanakh and from the languages there?
Yes, sir. It is varied in moving. And by the way, I may have just listed two different inventions together and botched them. My apology for anything unclear on the technology. But Son of God. Can be used in different ways. It can be used in terms of the angels, can be called sons of God. It can be used in terms of Israel, called God's son. It could be used in terms of the king, God's son. The New Testament terminology in Jewish background speaks of the messianic king in highly exalted terms as the unique son of God. But it would not be conceived as in the pagan world as the physical offspring of a deity that had come down and had relations with a woman. Thank you for the question. We'll take more questions, have answers tomorrow. My bottom line, let the word speak for itself in Hebrew without trying to read mystical, bizarre meanings into the text that aren't there.